Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really incredible founder joining us. You know, it's a founder that has done it multiple times. You know, a founder that has been able to accomplish, you know, building what ended up becoming a unicorn in Canada. I mean, think about that. You know, really incredible. And he's doing really tremendous stuff now, you know, with two of his most recent companies. So we're going to be thinking about, you know, and talking about narratives, you know, how to approach narratives with different VCs, how he was able to really grow and build, you know, that kind of a company, and also how he was able to exit, you know, partially, you know, that chapter to be a secondary, as well as to, you know, the way to think about governance, how to think about board seats, board members, so that you're not making, you know, the typical mistakes that you would see, because then, you know, once you've complicated things, then it's hard to really turn it around. And then as well, the balance between being a cash flow positive company and dealing with a VC growth mindset, which is something that is very much top of mind today with the macro environment, with that profit versus growth that we're dealing with. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Rob Imbo. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Alejandro. Glad to be here.
So originally born in Montreal. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Cold. Maybe that's just top of mind. Born and somewhat raised in Montreal. I did spend a few years in Hamilton, Ontario, which is a blue collar steel type area. I lived there, high school back in Montreal, did Cégep, which is our equivalent to college, and did a year of university. That didn't work out. Sort of floated around trying to figure things out. Was more of a computer engineer, just tinkering and hacking my way through it.
And Rob, before you continue here, I just want to double click on that, because people are probably wondering when listening here, what happened in college? Why didn't it work out, especially after the first year?
I think I was just too young. I really didn't appreciate academia, and sitting still is definitely not my strong point, as we'll get into.
Okay. I mean, and obviously, you know, like for the creators and for founders, you know, it's a repeated pattern, by the way. Now, in your case, it sounds like, you know, you came across a technical college, you know, where you ended up into the whole engineering, you know, thing. And that seemed to be clicking for you.
Yeah, I really fell in love with coding. Right. It just made sense to me. So I was able to kind of play. I had the technical college that worked out quite well. I was able to focus, hired right out of college to teach and then become an engineer at a small firm here in Ottawa.
So where do you think that problem solving mentality came from? Because obviously you got into the whole engineering and coding and putting pieces together. So where do you think that came from?
There's probably a lot of personal stuff that we can psychoanalyze that section. But I think really, I always had a love affair with math. I was on the math team. I really geeked out in there. And I loved equations. And I loved like the ability to make complex formulas be a bit more elegant and simple.
Now, for you, the as they say, entrepreneurs are either born or they're made. But it sounds like you had it in the family too.
I did. Yeah, my grandfather had one of the original six Canadian Tires. That's a big hardware store chain in Canada. And then he built out his own chain of hardware stores. He was very, you know, wealthy barber type person. Save around 10% of your gross every single paycheck. Don't borrow, cash flow positive, create a lifestyle business. Very, very much a mentor for sure.
So then I guess, hey, at what point did you know, or did you say to yourself, maybe one day I'll start something on my own?
I think I always knew, maybe not consciously, but I always knew I wanted to do something to make a difference, to make an impact. I didn't know what, but with my grandfather, he just said, you know, well, like, A, you create your own luck. He really instilled that early in my teens. Is like, forget the luck. It's like, you work your ass off. Luck will find you. I promise. So I took that to heart. And no matter what I work, even if my teenage years, I'm working at Foot Locker, if I'm working at a restaurant, like I did the work. And I saw the success. And I was, at one point, I loved working at Foot Locker. I thought that was going to be my life. But then you taste a little bit of success and I want to go up the ranks. And then you go up the ranks. You're like, why am I making these guys so much money? I can make my own difference.
And obviously, you know, as your grandfather was saying, you know, luck will follow. As they say, luck ultimately is preparation meets opportunity. Now, in your case, you're really creating that luck for you. Was when you started to build software. And, you know, eventually, you know, you started connecting with some friends and one thing led to the next and you ended up, you know, here with your first company. So how did that happen?
So I used to box. I boxed for 14 years. I was part owner in a boxing club. One of the guys I boxed with, which far, far better than me, I wasn't very good. But we became, you know, fast friends and he was working for a telecom company. And he said, you know what, like, I have this project manager, I have this small project, can you help me build a little piece of software? And it was like a call tracking software or whatever. And so I was working for that smaller company, went to my boss, and he's like, no, we're not going to do any free work, but you can do it on your own. Like, okay. So I did it, and that worked out, and his bosses liked it, and they asked for more. And so I went back. And at the same time, that company I was working for wasn't doing very well. And so I decided that I could run it better. I had no idea why. but I offered to buy him out. So went into credit card debt, took some loans and took a chance and hired, you know, bought out the assets and the staff and started building the company from scratch there.
So you guys were doing their B2B software for telecom companies, you know, amongst the other stuff. But this was ultimately what ended up being the segue to one of your biggest success, if not the biggest success to date. And that ended up being asset compliance. Now, in this case, you know, like with the company, you know, it ended up originating because you had a friend that had an idea around supply chain software. So walk us through, you know, what were those sequence of events that allow you to bring asset to life?
It's, I guess, friends of friends. The network knew that, you know, I was experiencing some success and I was good at what I did. And he pitched the idea. He's like this industry is ripe for software and for systems. And when he pitched it and he showed me his ideas, like I thought it was brilliant. He showed me the challenges and I said, okay, well, I'll build it. And you can become sales for the organization. He was still at another company. I built the first version in 12 days in my basement. I wasn't really coding as much then, but because I really relished it. I really loved it. I had fun building it with him. After 2 weeks, he sold the first version to an enterprise company. That which is unheard of. And so I'm just scrambling with myself and my very small team trying to keep up with these demands of this enterprise customer. And he continued to sell it. And all of the requirements from that first company really translated into a roadmap, essentially, for what we were to build. And earlier on, I had the idea of AI being a part of it. And we really tinkered with how we can automate supply chain management and transparency using some of the early tools in AI.
So you ended up incubating this as part of the 10 count, you know, company that you had initially purchased and that you were building. So how did that thought process work out of, hey, you know, let's keep building this within the umbrella of 10 count, or maybe let's do a rollout and let's have asset compliance become a company of its own?
Right. It really was about focus, which is something incredibly important. It was clear that this was going to outgrow 10 count. 10 count was doing two other arms with backups, with our own software and the telecom stuff. And we wanted to build something individual. So that broke up. There was three founders that broke that out in 2010. It was really about creating an organization around the one product, because focus is so incredibly important.
So then what ended up being the business model of Asset Compliance for the people that are listening to get it? How are you guys making money?
So we would go to a large hard good manufacturer. So think, you know, GE or Rolls-Royce or CAE. And they have to attest and prove all of the chemicals and goods and anything that would be harmful to the environment that will end up in a landfill 20 years from now. Really have to. So how we did it is we charged an upfront consulting fee and implementation fee, like a big analysis section. And then it was a SaaS company, really, above and beyond that. So they, every time, and what the beauty of it was, these regulations, they're always looking for substances of high concern, and these substances constantly change. So in most of them are in the EU, but if you think California has Prop 65, which started out with, you know, 400 or 500 substances, and like every quarter they would release new. So we would have new work every quarter, or we have to go, you know, re-engage with the supply chain to see, you know, okay, how do these substances exist in your parts and in your assemblies? So it really was a SaaS company, really is a SaaS company.
So in this case, you know, for you guys, you know, how also was the, you know, the idea of eventually raising money? Because I mean, the first thing I would say 18 months there, you know, you guys were like doing this, like for the most part, like bootstrapped, no, like without really like VCs pumping money into this. So how did you go through those 18 months to really build such an incredibly demanding company like this, you know, because obviously you need capital to build this. And then at what point were you guys, you know, thinking like, hey, maybe it makes sense to open up, you know, here the doors to external money, to VCs?
A few things happened. So yeah, early stage was very much bootstrap. My sales guy, my sales partner, the initial founder, really, he was living off of lines of credit. you know, when he quit his job to do this full time, my other partner and I, like we had 10 count to pay our salaries earlier on, but it was becoming clear that it was going to need a lot more heads, and so yeah, we went as far as we could. Every time we got a new client, we hired a couple of new staff, and we did it, you know, slow growth style there, and we were at about 25 people, so we managed to get quite far, but. My third founder, and boxing again, he met, one of the most successful venture capitalists in Canadian history. And he was fighting on this, charity boxing event. He was just leaving another company called Pythian, that he took from, I think, 40 million to 400 million. And he was leaving that. He was pretty much looking for a place to work. So he came to work out of our offices, and for 3 months just sat meetings and took notes. And he eventually became our CEO. And with his extensive experience as a VC, he knew the game, right? So he was definitely our biggest mentor in the raising capital game. And so he initiated that Series A. He came on very, you know, modestly came on, and then just sort of led the way with that Series A, and really taught us about timing, really tailoring your pitches and pitch decks to the types of VCs and what the narratives are for their specific funds, because they have their own investment thesis. He ended up, he definitely led the way. And we ended up with 5 term sheets in 2 weeks' time. So we were able to pick and choose the best part. Those pitches, especially at the third and second stage of engagement, it's really a two-way street, right? You don't want to take just anybody's money. You really want the VCs to bring value. We landed on Volition, and they were great.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And in total for the company, how much has the company raised to date?
$660 million US.
And then when you were talking about the narrative and tweaking the narrative, depending on who you're speaking with, how do you go about that so that you don't like overcomplicate yourself and also so that you make it, you know, effective as a process?
Yeah, you always have your basic tenets. You have your origin story. The numbers are the numbers. In the case, so fast forward to where I am now, really like with climate tech, you need sustainability numbers. You want your impact, and they ask a lot of impact. I think in preparation, I think things like PitchBook, I mean, there's a reason why it's so expensive because you can go into PitchBook and look at a file of a VC and you can see their win loss. You can see their allocation by industry. You can see their investment thesis. You see the people, how many board seats they want. And you can tailor those pitches, right? You can go into a VC and be like, listen, like your last two wins were in climate tech, but your allocation is only 5%. Maybe we should double that and invest in us. And here's where we match. And we really demonstrate that we understand the power law. And honestly, that's another way. Even though university didn't work out for me, I'm a big lifelong learner. I read everything I get a hold of, or watch or consume. By the way, I share all of that on my socials. I have like, this is what I consumed this week. And I follow, you know, the Bill Gurley's of the world and the, like the All In podcast I quite enjoy. And I temper that with other finance. So I think going in with a knowledge of really understanding the power law game from this side, you can really appreciate the other side. And I'm a big fan of BATNA, right? Like if you read Getting to Yes, I think your listeners would probably know. I'm not like a strong arm guy. I go in with the best alternatives. I want to understand. I want wins on both sides. And being an asshole nowadays, you know, just doesn't work. And yeah, with the macro environment right now, we don't have those chances anyway. But as long as you have like your numbers are solid, then yeah, you're good.
So then eventually, you know, it comes to terms. You know, there's a private equity firm that comes in, and that opens up the opportunity for you know, doing a secondary. You know, where ultimately existing shareholders are able to sell their shares. And this got you into retirement. So walk us through what you were thinking, you know, obviously after having spent, you know, quite a bit of time. I mean, you were in it, you know, for close to 10 years, but why did you say to yourself, maybe it's time for me to take this now, do a secondary transaction and go into retirement at the age of 45?
Well, 10 count. I mean, so Ascent was only 10 years, but I was an entrepreneur since 2003. Yeah. I think There's a lot of factors, and this is very much personal more than anything. I took a little secondary in 2017, and I sold everything, and I wanted to leave. But my biggest thing was my daughter. My first daughter was born, and I wanted to see her grow up. I just didn't like startup life is what it is. There's no balance if you want to be great, and that's okay. I think, right? It's peaks and valleys. But that there's very little balance if you really want to pursue greatness. That's a fun negotiation right now with two daughters. I took it because it was 15 years of sludgery. It wasn't that much. It wasn't something that could keep me going forever. I just had enough to not be in debt and live comfortably with my wife, and we went to Southeast Asia for 10 months just with our 18-month-old and just traveled. We're pretty much homeless.
That's amazing. So you did the retirement thing for about, I mean, close to 5 years. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, you were obviously able to raise your daughter and be there, you know, and experience those first years, which is incredible. Now, once an entrepreneur, as they say, always an entrepreneur. So at what point, you know, you didn't go at it just like, again, you went at it like, double the trouble, you know, with two companies, with Farm Anywhere and then also Hearty Food. So walk us through how the whole incubation, you know, of these ideas came about, and why did you felt at that point, you know, in 2022, that it was the right time to get back into it again?
I mean, if you use the word retirement around my wife, she'd probably laugh. As we traveled, I wrote two books. And so I was given, you know, 2.5 hours every day to write every single day wherever we were. And I came in, and I was also a little bit of an angel investor, because I love meeting founders and entrepreneurs. Like, they, you know, I think they're going to change the world, and they continue to do so. I don't know if you just saw that speech by Mille and the World Economic Forum yesterday. Entrepreneurs are heroes. It's incredibly inspiring. I encourage all entrepreneurs to go listen to it. I was doing some angeling. I loved the entrepreneurs, and then I met one through a friend, and I loved his energy. He was living downtown Toronto in a really high paying job with his wife. And they sold everything, and they wanted to start their own functional mushrooms company. It was just making tinctures. And they moved to like northern Quebec in the middle of winter to stay in a motel to learn how wild harvesting works. And I just love operators. I love true operators that just give it. And he was doing a raise for, I think, $750,000 or something around that. And I had breakfast with them. And he just sort of expressed his worries. Like, I'm taking other people's money, so I'm taking this seriously, and it's giving me anxiety. I'm like, and I just said, okay, well, what if that was 10 million? Actually, what if it was 50 million? What would you do if you raised $50 million right? And his eyes just lit up. It's as if he saw the Matrix. And he had an extreme calm. He's like, yeah, I guess that it's the same amount of anxiety, no matter how much you're raising. Right, it's going to be a matter of impact and pricing and all that, but I mean, really, what are you going to do with that? And he thought very seriously about it. So I came in as an investor, and we looked into something else, but then we founded this vertical farming company based on mushrooms, where we grow and sell mushrooms at its core. But we really delve deeply into the technology. And like, I came on as a volunteer, so I pretty much just paid for the privilege to work with him. And then it was about a year into it, I was like, you know what, I think this vertical farming has something really special, and we can attack the food system in a special way, and we are doing it. This is our second year. We just 7x extra revenue, and we're looking for global growth. We did a seed round with Congruent Ventures, one of the biggest climate tech venture firms out of SF, who have been incredible. And we're doing our Series A now, and very much in like we discussed earlier, the VC mindset, right? The growth mindset, which is a funny thing in itself.
And how did you combine that with Hearty Foods as well?
So that is Hearty Foods. And so our model was to grow mushrooms in these shipping container farms. And so we outsourced growing the building, the manufacturing of these farms. And this company that built them for us was absolute shit, and just did not build what they promised and overcharged and didn't work. And so I partnered with an engineer, savant, and said, we'll just build them ourselves. And then I just personally invested in Farm Anywhere in order to service Hardy, essentially. But Farm Anywhere became its own thing as well. So that's like an opportunity for revenue. And that's why the two companies, they're very much interconnected.
So then let's talk about the future. Because obviously there's like a lot going on now, especially around this space. So let's say you were to go to sleep tonight, Rob, and you wake up in a world where the vision of this whole thing is fully realized. What does that world look like?
So we have farms across the globe. We have thousands of farms. Each farm can, you know, produce between $250,000 each in revenue. We've added new crops. We've changed the food systems. We've attracted the next generation of farmers, something both the US and Canada sorely need because there's no succession plan. I think we've really influenced the food system in a hugely possible way. And we grow our food sustainably as well. I think we really share what we've learned, other people could do it too. So I mean, it's food, right? I mean, competitors are competitors, but we're all in the same game. You know, we're growing food. So I think of them as colleagues more than anything.
And how have you been thinking too about, you know, now let's say getting into that future, you know, thinking about governance, you know, on board seats and board members? How do you think that going through all these different experiences with different companies has shaped your mindset around that?
Yeah, really learning the board game over the past decade. Early on, I really didn't understand. I was on a board of a big nonprofit. Didn't really get it. You know, they brought me on to bring entrepreneurial eyes on an old system, but I couldn't really make an impact. With respect to these companies, so important to get it right at the beginning. And it may be controversial, but there is impermanent board seats. It could be a term, you know, 2-year term, including the founders, right? If you're willing to put your money where your mouth is. And really outlining the game. If some board members are acting in their own interests, you know, versus the fiduciary duty of the company, I think that could be a challenge. And people are people, right? I think, and really getting board members that understand the game in which you're about to embark on. Like if we are in a high growth, we're not going to be cash flow positive, right? We're going to spend as if more money's coming. And that's okay. That's high growth doesn't mean profit. And that also means dilution, right? So like if you're a board member, generally, you're probably an investor or founder, you're going to get diluted. And I think that's okay. If you're 20xing your value, but you're taking a 20% dilution hit, you're still pretty much cash happy, right? So like really understanding those numbers, and you're building value. I think that's the goal, and getting that ironed out early is such a big deal.
So as we're thinking about lessons here learned, you know, I want to put you into a time machine, and everyone, I want to bring you back in time, Rob. And
man, I'm going back and forth.
Let's say I'm taking you back. I'm taking you back, you know, maybe to, I don't know, let's say like to the early 2000s. No, let's say, or maybe like to that. Yeah. 2003, you know, right before you were about to pull your credit card and get into massive debt, you know, to buy, you know, what ended up becoming 10 count, your first baby. But let's say you were able to stop yourself on the tracks right there. And let's say you're able to give that younger Rob one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Um, I don't know. And I know this is something you ask, but I would say stop worrying. Really just enjoy those moments. Like earlier on, like the first big project we got, it was three of us. And you may not remember, but in 2003, there was a big major blackout across the Eastern Seaboard, and including New York City. It was crazy. And the company we're working for, we had like 4 months to finish this project. It was based on their backup software. And that event had them come back. So, can you build a bare bones version in 6 days? And so the three of us, we got a bunch of cots and we coded for 6 days. In the morning we coded, in the afternoon we troubleshoot, we deploy, troubleshoot, and then we code. And we just did that like solid. We didn't sleep. And it was so stressful, but like it's so fun in hindsight, like just to enjoy those moments. Like now I look back on it, just like, oh my God, that was amazing. I love that. And maybe a little bit of that is what's translated here, right? We're just in a fun little startup office here with 35 people. It's pretty much tiny right now, like, and knowing everybody and like this stage, you know, it's okay to call the company family. I don't buy into all this nonsense on social media. It's like, don't call your staff your family. It's like, no, I mean, the early stage 10 counters were my family. The early stage Accenture's, probably the first 50 of them, were my family. And these guys are. I know it turns into something else over time, but like, you know, I think it turns into a professional sports team. So I would really say, like, enjoy those, savor those moments.
I love it. So, Rob, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
I'm most active on LinkedIn and X. I post everything on LinkedIn. I'm quite thoughtful of what I put up. And every week I post what I consume. My entire reading list, I keep on Goodreads just to share as much as I possibly can. I have a book called Before I Leave You. It's not really about startups or anything. It's more about a past trauma, but it's in the mental health space. Very much an advocate in the mental health space, especially for founders.
what's the name of the book?
It's called Before I Leave You.
Before I Leave You. And where can people find the book?
Amazon, all the big retailers. I've never not responded to someone reaching out. So that book just hit 10,000. So I'm actually extremely proud, and I donate 100% of proceeds from that book to mental health care. So,
well, obviously, you know, entrepreneurship involves depression, unfortunately. And, yes. You know, I think that mental health is a really big thing, you know, in the venture world that I think that people are more conscious around it, you know, definitely very, very, relevant topic. So, definitely encourage everyone to take a look at it. So, Rob, I just want to thank you, you know, really for taking the time. And it has been a tremendous honor to have you on the show today. So thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you. And thank you for your podcasts. It's inspiring. Love it.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.